All right, so I'll start the last presentation of the day. Mine, which is called Tibetan Corpus Linguistics, Present Obstacles and Future Prospects. Looking at the structure of my presentation, first I'll look at the current analytical obstacles that we're facing, then some software development desiderata, then some research questions. These are sort of questions that have arisen in the context of the works we've done so far, but which we haven't had a chance to explore. And then future collaborations and future and possible research projects. Okay. So, I'll just list a few analytical hurdles. They may sound like a word salad to begin with, but then I'll go into more detail. So we have the demonstrative use of relator nouns, zero nominalization of verbs, names, and a few tricky words. Okay, so the demonstrative use of relator nouns. This is a case where, let's say, I mentioned to some people, early on in the project, after 10,000 words, we fixed the tag set because you can't always be adding new tag categories for, well, because the computer can never figure out what's going on if you're always moving the goalpost. Yeah? But it does mean that then we ran into some phenomena we hadn't anticipated, and we had to decide, are they more like this or are they more like that, and develop a sort of protocol about where to put them. And then, in retrospect, you may second-guess some of these judgments. So this is a case of this type. We have demonstratives like di and de, which mean this or that. And in many contexts, like Gyalpo di, this king, it's clear they're demonstrative, no problem. But also you can have demonstratives without antecedents for spatial or temporal reference. In this case, we have the gods and men who gathered there. Der, in that place, zoppe lami, the gods and men who gathered there. So the day in this instance has no antecedent. It's not in that temple or in that park. It's just there. So we tag this as demonstrative effectively because then we don't increase the ambiguity. It's what the computer recommended anyhow. But because of that context, as a sort of analogy, we find ourselves also tagging other sort of spatial adverbs, if you like, as demonstratives. So for instance, in this sentence, we have, while they were returning back down, passing in front of a cave, so pukpe of a cave, dunna in front, mar down, lok return, dro jing going, dukpala, so they were going, where mar is downward. So this stem, ma, basically isn't used except in the terminative case, meaning downward. We didn't have any special tag for spatial adverbs, so we tagged it as a demonstrative. Then, having established that protocol, we then also found ourselves tagging as demonstratives relator nouns used without, when they're not being used as relator nouns. So, a relator noun, actually we have a nice one here, pukpe dunna, in the front of. We call those a relator noun, they're like a postposition or something like that. But in a case like this, well, let's just look at the case first. We have, because neither clothes outside nor nourishment inside, whether food or drink, had he any, his body became like a skeleton. We only have to look at the first part. Pina ge tang. Nang na soe chetang. So chetang chu, yes. So we have on the outside clothes and on the inside sort of meal-like nourishment and drink.
So is it correct in this pina?
Yeah, it's probably incorrect. Yeah. It's probably just me not typing correctly. Because I read it as China, right? So it's yeah, but it's probably just me typing up incorrectly.
But it corresponds to modern Hassa, probably spelling about this, right? For the foreigners.
Ah, yeah. So okay, this was just a typo, I think. But in any case, you have, let's say it's China. It doesn't mean on the outside of something. It just means on the outside. And nangna on the inside. You know, you can explain, or it means on the outside of his body, but there's nothing in the text that suggests there's a body. It's a sort of antecedentless use of a relator noun. And our computer doesn't like to use to call something a relator noun because we told it to, when it doesn't have something to its left, something like, for instance, bar can be a relator noun, but then also in something like barga, then it's not, it doesn't mean in between anything in particular, so we tag it just as a noun. So we had to tag these as something, so we did demonstratives. But now you can see how we've wandered quite far away from sort of demonstrative uses of demonstratives, and in fact, maybe all of these things should have been given some other tag, spatial adverb or something like that. So this, you know, it just shows you the kinds of confusion and hesitance that comes up as we do these things, and how you make a decision that seems well motivated, and that it ends up leading you in slightly strange directions. Zero nominalization of verbs is, let's say, a real problem in terms of these demonstrative uses of relator nouns don't make the computer, you know, upset, but this does. So, in general, Tibetan requires some kind of suffix in order to nominalize a verb. We have monosyllabic verb stems, and you put a pa or a ken or a tsul or something on the end of a verb in order to make it into a noun. But sometimes they just leave it out. Yeah? So here's an easy case. We have the words of the guru, which are not ignorant, are as pure as space. La me sung of the guru, his words, marik, ignorance, minpa, are not, so are not ignorance, ying, space, ying su, in space, tang, pure. And here, marik, we're tagging just as a noun, because it works. It's a noun, it means ignorance. But structurally speaking, it's a negated verb. So I would have written, if I were writing this, marik pa, and then I could have had a nominalized verb with a nice negation prefix, so I could have reflected the kind of had a tiny mini clause that then is functioning as a noun constituent in a sentence. But they didn't put the pa there, so then I'm forced to treat it as unanalyzable noun. And in general, this has been our approach. Because of cases like this, it feels perfectly comfortable, at least to me, to just say this is a noun, it means ignorance. But then you find yourself making longer and longer nouns and hiding more and more interesting verb syntax inside of them, and that just doesn't feel quite right. So I'll give you some examples that felt so not quite right that I haven't done it. I haven't made everything into a big noun, and so it's actually coming up with an error message in the system. So here we have dir shuk sen chik. Dir, kind of here in the terminative case. Juk is to reside. Sen, listen. Chik is sort of imperative marker. So listen, O you who sit here. Well, this should have been juk ba or juk ken, someone who sits. But it's not. So what we did in this case was we treated it as a noun. Fine, we have a new noun. Juk means people who sit. Except it's still governing stuff to its left. And if there weren't a case marker there, I might even say, like, you know, if it were Kim Juk or something, those who sit in houses, why not? It's a compound, it's a noun. But it's not a compound because you have the case marking there. It's definitely still governing. So how do I tag this? If I tag it as a finite verb, I'm lying because it's not functioning as a finite verb. If I tag it as a verbal noun, it would mean that suddenly all finite verbs can just function as verbal nouns without being nominalized. Yeah. Or maybe there should be a special new tag. You know, this is a real problem. And most of our examples of not being 100% accurate are, I would say half of them, are zero nominalization verbs where I just don't know what to do. This one, let's say, any Tibetologist will have an intuition of it being pretty okay, actually, but it's still technically the same problem. We have free from the two obscurations of taken and taker. I should have had, you know, tekendum or something like this, because it's a future stem and not a past stem. So free, dral, free of the two obscurations of taking, and here you get the pa, just like I want, the present tense followed by a pa to be nominalized, and this is the associative case marker, which means it has to have a noun to its left. But what do you get? You get zum, just a present tense verb form, as if it were finite. You should have had zum wa or zum cha or, you know, I don't know, something with some nominalized form. I think here what's going on is they're just, they feel like, well, you've got the pa there, yeah, so good enough. but I don't have a good, and even I have a sense that actually it would have been sort of bad style to say zum wa tang zin pa, because it's too many pa's. But just in terms of purely how do I tag it, it's a problem. And then a nice longer one, I'll read the English first. Pride, and so, actually some of you will, I think, Dorji might remember this from my Facebook.
Yeah.
pride and lack of faith, lack of interest and being distracted outward, being withdrawn inward, and dejection, these are the flaws of listening. So I'm going to look at this phrase, tondu nyerwa me ni tam, which is the lack of interest. This is all the lack of interest. Yeah. So tondu, towards the meaning, nyerwa, paying attention, that's a nice nominalized verb. Me, to not exist, and here's the problem. It's not nominalized. Ni, I don't really want to speculate about exactly the different uses ni, but it's comfortable at towards the right edge of noun phrases. And tongue is an associative case, which means it's a noun phrase. So this is all a noun phrase. Here I have an embedded verbal noun, which is governing this, fine. But then this is a verb that is governing this, but it itself is not nominalized. One possibility is to say that the ni is a nominalization suffix.
But abstract, that, to the abstract noun.
Yeah, maybe, but this seems quite ad hoc to me. You know, I would want to know that there are lots of me ni's out there in the world. I would have wanted to have me pa, or even me pa ni, or something like that.
I mean, of course, you completely ignore the fact that we are dealing here with first metric causa.
Oh, yeah. But here's the issue is, in Tibetan, we have this attitude, which is, in verse, all rules are off. Yeah? And my feeling is, you know, it could be that in verse, there are different rules. One thing I've started to do when I just sit around, listen to like pop songs, is look for grammar that you can get away with in a pop song, but not in normal English. And God, there's someone who had a line in a love song, get away and stay from here, where clearly the away is meant to be doubled. It's not good English, but it was in a pop song by a native speaker of English, so it shows that also in English verse, the rules are slightly different. But the rules being slightly different is different than there are no rules. And so this is a problem. How do we model what happens in verse? In general, our approach to verse has been just make it all long nouns. It's like Sanskrit, just whole lines of verse are nouns. Here you can't do that because of this case marker. Yeah? This is a nice verb phrase. So if I stuck this ni on and nominalized this, I would have to nominalize from here to here.
Yeah, we could say absence of, I mean, may ni, like, a non-existence of, so to say.
Then you would have to have nye, nye, we.
Yeah,
okay. Not in the verse.
Okay, the point is, I don't know how to tag it. Yeah? There's a technical problem to be solved in terms of the tagging. Let me move along. We can come back to this one if you like.
Poor choice of corpus.
Pardon?
Poor choice of corpus, maybe.
Yeah. I've tried to avoid verse, actually, but you can't avoid it. Tibetans just, you know, they're like doing their taxes and they leap into verse, yeah? So names we've referred to before. So we've been trying to improve the consistency of our word breaking so that the statistical model has an easier job and can make word breaking, you know, if you feed it more consistent material, you'll get more consistent behavior from it. And then we ran into this problem of names that contain grammar. So we have Chugilodro, which can either mean intelligence of Dharma, or it can just be a guy whose name is Chugilodro. And then also we have this one I find very funny name, but it's in the Zangdung. Someone whose name is Gyalpoy Kap, So King's Palace. It almost sounds like a, you could get it, this is like a British last name, you know. Edward Kingspolis. So if our approach has been to tag it all as one word, fine, it is one word, it's a name. But then the corpus...
Is it the king's wife by any chance?
No, it's palace. Cup is a, can mean needle and wife and palace. Mm-hmm. So maybe, actually, in a name, you don't know. Maybe the guy's name is King's Needle. Mm-hmm. Yeah? but in this section of the Zonglin, you have a lot of people going to the palace, people mm-hmm. staying in the palace. So I assumed it was a palace. But anyhow, the syntactic analysis is clear. So what the cup means is beside the point. Tagging it as one word introduces inconsistency in the word breaking, which means there's a certain consistency of word breaking we're unable to achieve because of words like this. So the answer we asked around, and the answer is that we should have another stage, like between part of speech tagging and lemmatizing, of named entity recognition lookup, yeah? So we should break it up, apparently, like you would say, American telephone and telegraph is a series of adjectives and nouns and stuff. Just say American adjective, telephone, noun, and conjunction. And then have some abstract tagging or so second set of tags or something that say these are all part of a name of a corporation. So because this the constraint grammar allows more than one tag, we're now thinking about going back and pulling all these names apart and then having the first tag be the sort of the internal part of speech, and then the second tag be first syllable of a name or something like that. So maybe those of you who have experience can, at the end, advise me about whether you think this is a good approach or something like that. Anyhow, some tricky words. These are words that are quite frequent and very promiscuous in terms of their syntactic behavior, where it's hard to know exactly where to slice them up. So looking at rang first, we say it's a reflexive pronoun in a sentence like, he was sent to wake his own daughters. It's the own in own daughters. Pumo is daughter. Pumo nam, daughters. Rangi, his own. So it's a, if you were ever going to call anything a reflexive, it would be this. Now, in sort of more recent forms of Tibetan, personal pronouns oftentimes just incorporate this rang. So kierang is how you say you, ngarang is how you say I. But in earlier Tibetan, you don't have the rang there. And, I think everyone agrees that originally, ke was you, and then they said ke rang to mean you yourself. And in the way now that actually as a hypercorrection in white English, people say myself when they just mean me in order to sound pretentious. I think the Tibetans did something like this until the reflexive became part of the pronoun. But because of our approach to word breaking, we have to treat it, which is to mean diachronically comparable. We have to treat it as a separate word. Because it's etymologically it reflects a pronoun, we tag it as a reflective pronoun. So we also have rang rarely, and this I feel a little uncomfortable with, but it's in our corpus, so I might as well tell you about it. Personal pronoun rang. Here is a sort of distributive use of rang. We have they hit each other, rang gi, so erget marger, rang la. So one to another, chop top, they made hits or something like that. So maybe we should have just said, okay, reflexive, distributive, they're basically the same thing anyhow, it's fine to tag it. But somehow that's not what the annotator did, and then things went off in that direction. So we called it a personal pronoun because it's sort of standing where a personal pronoun would. You would say he hit her or something like that. And then the intuition, I think, basically led to this analysis of the example is, the grammars tell us that rang can just stand in place of the first person or the second person pronoun in certain texts or certain genres. We don't have any clear examples in our corpus, but everyone says it happens, so we thought, if we were to see that, this is how we would tag it. And then we have rang, the determiner. A determiner, I don't know, I have a rigorous definition for it. Something that likes to live at the right end of a noun phrase. Pyole, Rempo rang jik, one more assiduous even than thou, where this rong is the even. So we have kyo, thou, le, van, rempo, assiduous, rong, even, jik, a. Yeah? So this is definitely not reflexive in terms of the syntax. It's just some sort of modifier to the adjective. And we've been tagging these as determiners. But then we get an example like this, and all kinds of examples where we have certain kind of inconsistency in the corpus, where we have lala nare marpa rang nyong ne. So some said Marpa himself had gone crazy, or some said Marpa had gone crazy. So we have lala, some, nare said Marpa rang nyong ne had gone crazy. So is this, it's a personal name. You know, there's not a reflexive, it's not like Marpa shaved himself, yeah? There's no actual reflexive, but it's also not this determiner use, because then, well, it might be, I don't know. It's, there's no adjective there. You know, if they had said Marpa, you know, Nyungpo or something, Rang Gyur, then I would have felt comfortable tagging it as a determiner. So I don't actually know what this rong means in this position with confidence. So I'm not sure how to tag it. And in cases like this, we just, you know, it's just with, there's the annotators are totally inconsistent. So the Holy Spirit comes and says, oh, this one's reflexive or something like that. So we need to study more our own approach to rong. And if you have any ideas, please tell me. And then the re has a lot of similar issues. We have an indefinite pronoun, where basically it's a syntactic constituent. Here, our friend Rong is back, but this Rong is clear. But the re, so each one of them, each person, is some kind of pronoun, right? And then a determiner, each just meaning like, so this is, we were talking about barley over earlier. Here's the barley. Ne, kel, re, each load of barley. So mother cooked up each load of barley that she had into three great measures of beer. Pardon?
She brewed it.
Brewed, okay, fine. Brewed. Cooked up. I don't make beer out of barley very often. She tooted it. Yeah. So it's re sort of towards the right edge of a noun phrase. That's we call things determiners if they come sort of after adjectives in particular. So, fine. So that's re. We also have re as a noun. Rejik, meaning one time, you know, like un fois, mal, and mal, yeah. And then re, meaning hope. And then re, we also heard as a cardinal number. So you have jo re, jo do, 1 or 2 ounces. So this, I think etymologically speaking, we only have two reis here. We have the re that means hope, and we have the other re, which is sort of each one sort of stuff, yeah? But you see how, because of that, you have sort of maybe one etymological item that has quite a promiscuous syntactic behavior where, you know, I would never have told my students that re was a number, but you know, the do, I mean, I don't know. This seems like a sensible way of tagging this passage as numbers. Okay, that was it for the hurdles we're facing. Now we just fantasize about what things computers might be able to do. So, currently the process of recompiling and retagging, it's sort of, I get to a certain point, I deal with errors, I fix things in the lexicon, I write some new rules, and then I want to sort of reset the system. So I write to Ed and I say, Ed, do whatever it is you do. And then he does, and then that there's a certain lag there, and it's the two, as we were referring to it earlier, as a sort of two-body problem. That's still happening on email, actually. This is not, we don't have an automatic notification system for that. It would be nice if somehow there were just some big red button on the website somewhere that just said recompile, yeah, and then I wouldn't have to waste this time with it effectively. Then also, remembering back to this morning, we have this consistency checker that works both for word breaking and for part of speech tagging that was given to us by Pablo Faria. It works offline, and similarly, I sent him a, I think, well, horizontal or vertical, I don't think it matters, but I send him the corpus, he runs his software audit, he sends me back the output, which means that something like this problem with names comes up, there are lots of inconsistencies that even after I correct them, they're there in the output of the thing he sent me. It's not dynamic, it's quite inefficient, I don't want to send him a file every afternoon, yeah? So it would be nice somehow if his algorithm, his software, could be embedded in our workflow. So just like you had the rule-based tagger flagging suggestions, you might have the consistency checker flagging suggestions. I also think there's room for having a word-based consistency checker. Sorry, rule-based. Yeah, rule-based. So Pablo's is statistical. He has a statistical consistency checker. I think that there's intellectual room for a rule-based approach, which I'll describe in a little bit. And then all of this is to say, I think that it would be nice to have a seamless web interface. Another kind of offline thing that happens is people take the machine output, put it in a spreadsheet, fix it in a spreadsheet, send it back to Ed, he uploads it. It would somehow be nice if you could just have the machine output and tell it, live online, your word breaking's wrong here, get rid of this part of speech tagger. And that would, for instance, allow more people, you know, you could just open it up to the public, and if someone wanted to tag some Tibetan text, they could, and we could keep track of that. People could use it for pedagogical uses. I think lowering the transaction costs of the average Tibetan reader using our system is a good idea. And a seamless web interface is a part of that. So just, I mentioned this idea of a post hoc rule-based consistency checker, and I just want to go into that in a little bit of detail, show you what I mean. Our rule-based tagger, what it does is it tries to start from scratch itself. It says, I've just got Tibetan, I'm going to word break it, I'm going to part of speech tag it using the lexical tagger, then I run the rule-based tagger, and then I show it to the person. There's no way for it to learn from the people, except in the general sense of what's in its lexicon. But that means that it allows for certain things that are actually impossible. And I give you the example here of migawa can have two meanings. It can either mean not happy, in which case mi is a negation marker, and the verb has to be non-past, or it can mean a happy person, in which case mi is a noun, and gawa can be any tense. So our system will not flag anything as incorrect if you have either of these sequences. But they're nonsense in Tibetan. They just don't mean anything. So you could ask yourself, well, if a human being allowed for one of these impossible combinations, what did they mean to do? And I think the answer is that a human being is more likely to get right whether the me means person or negation than they are to get right the selection of tenses in the nominalized verb, because they have to remember things like me doesn't allow for the past tense. Yeah, so I think people are better at knowing kind of what's the general gist. Does it mean happy person or does it mean not happy? And they may not remember all of these niceties about syntax. So you could say, you could add a rule that consults what's actually there in the human output and says, if me is tagged as noun count and you have this tag for the gawa, that's a mistake and change the gawa. And it could do that automatically. And then similarly, you could say, if the me is tagged as negation, then if the gawa is tagged as any stem, delete out the past. So you're saying basically there's an inconsistency, but I have a sense of what was meant, so I'll force that interpretation. And then at least you have something that's possible Tibetan rather than something that's not. Just another example that I'm not quite sure is straightforward is dei tse could either mean at that time or it could mean his life. And when it means at that time, we tag it proclausal adverb, genitive, and relator noun. And when it means his life, we tag it demonstrative, genitive, and noun. So again, there are two patterns that our computer currently allows for, but which are nonsense in terms of Tibetan grammar. And you could set up Here, my intuition, I don't know about you, but my intuition is a human being is more likely to correctly distinguish when from life than he is de in the sense of having a clear antecedent from de having some sort of vague clause as its antecedent. So then you could say, okay, trust the human being when he says what tse is, and then force the correct interpretation on the de. So this is something I would like to see and would add consistency to our part of speech tagger, which would mean there are fewer mistakes, also better for training statistical taggers. So now, some questions, some possible research questions that came up in the course of doing this project. The first one is conflicts between Dadra Sandhi rules and syntactic cues to verb stem disambiguation. This is the only one I'll go into in a little bit of detail, so let's do it. We have this sentence, which is, this apple was not born from fruit, but I found it in the middle of a spring, so I cannot find it hereafter. It will not be encountered. This is a king who was, this is a servant to a king, where the king had eaten a very delicious apple, and he said, give me more of these. But it had come from a naga living in a spring. It hadn't come from an apple tree, so it's a not reproducible apple. We're just going to look at the mi jor po, which means it will not be encountered. So mi is negation marker, jo is the verb to encounter, and then to is a sort of finite verb suffix. The fact that it's to rather than ro means that there's a secret D here, the dadra, which was written as the upper the superscript D in Abel's handout. And that means that from the perspective of the sandhi, it should be a past. However, you notice it's negated mi, and the negation with mi does not permit the past. It has to be present or future. So this is, in a sense, a real problem. The phonology and the syntax are heading in opposite directions. We chose very early on, for various reasons in the projects, in such cases, to order the rules in order to defer to the syntax. So we will tag this as present and not as past. But in fact, you could order those rules differently and get different results. And it would be interesting to tag the whole corpus twice, once doing dadra rules and then syntax, once doing syntax rules and then dadra, and just see, flag all of those cases where the phonology and the syntax are disagreeing with each other, and then maybe we have something to learn about Tibetan grammar there. Maybe we don't fully understand negation or dadra sandhi. So this is just, I'm saying, if you order it one way, you get one output. If you order it the other way, you get another output. And then, as we currently have the system, you don't see the result, right? The ordering of the rules decides the output. So this would require a sort of special research project to look at. Okay. So now just some other possible questions that we've thought about. When you get things like reduplicated verbs or other ways of coordinating verbs, verb patang, verb te, verb ching, you are tempted as an annotator to not think that they're totally independent, their tenses. So maybe somehow, ching implies that both verbs are the same tense, or in a reduplicated setting, both verbs are in the same tense. We haven't been modeling that at all, and I think it would need investigation before we decide. We need to look at all the different ways that Tibetan can coordinate verbs and whether those have predictable effects on the selection of the verb tense. And then if we find those patterns, we can use them to further disambiguate the selection of the verb tense in verbs that don't have morphologically distinct tenses. And then something that, so there's only one punctuation mark in Tibetan, the she. It looks like like the pipe, more or less. And it can be used to mark sentence ends, clause ends, anything that you would use a period, a colon, a semicolon for in English. The only thing they've got is the she. So we use the she a lot. For instance, Tibetan's verb final, so if there's something that could be a verb or a noun and it occurs before she, it's probably a verb. For the same reason, if something that could be a verb or could be a noun and it occurs after she, it means that it's at the beginning of some chunk, so it's probably a noun. But this is assuming that the she is marking clause boundaries or sentence boundaries, If it's just a list, for instance, you know, A, B, C, D, each one with a she in between it, then that those intuitions are wrong. Similarly, in poetry, you just, every nine syllables or every seven syllables, you just stick a she whether you need one or not, which means that these syntactic generalizations fall apart. So one thing I've wondered is whether you could just look at the span of text between two shes and see whether they cluster, where, for instance, a she to offset members of a list are going to be short sort of spans of words between the she, whereas shes to mark clauses are going to be longer. And then if you had a sort of fairly robust clustering phenomena, you could say all the rules in which we evoke a she don't evoke the rule if there's another she within a span of five words or something like that. But to do that, we would need to investigate the behavior of the she in more detail than we have. How do conditional clauses work in Tibetan? And this gets back a little bit to what I was talking about this morning with all these na yang and na ni and na go and na ta. There's a lot going on in Tibetan conditionals, even in terms of tense selection. You have, in a conditional, you have the protasis and the apotasis. I don't think anyone's ever looked at if you have a present in the protasis and a past in the apotasis, what combinations are tested, what do they imply in terms of the semantics. Whereas, for instance, when you take Greek, they teach you quite early on, you know, a little bit artificially, but we have the future more vivid, future less vivid, the counter to factual. I, as a teacher of Tibetan, would really like to have some way of saying, you know, this is how conditional clauses work. And frankly, it's a bit of an embarrassment, I think, to the discipline that we don't have any kind of analysis of conditionals. And then we touched on this a little bit, I think, earlier, law. If in the handbooks, usually, you say law coordinates imperatives. So if I say shut up and sit down, that and is going to be a law. Whereas, for instance, to coordinate nouns, it would be a tam. To coordinate other tenses of verbs, it would be a te or a chin or something like that. So we're tempted to say something like, if a verb stem could be an imperative and is followed by law, then it is an imperative. However, it doesn't work. There are other uses of law that seem to be out there. One sort of conjecture that you may hear about is that law comes after adjectives, but in fact it's some kind of verbs, like che to be big or ze to be beautiful. So if you say she's a big, beautiful gal, you could say something like pumo ze la che or something like that. But this is something that deserves more systematic investigation. What kinds of verbs does the law coordinate? So now turning to future collaborations, these are collaborations that have been discussed with these partners. So there's the Tibetan Buddhist Resource Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They're doing now, they're OCRing their, so for 10 years they've collected Tibetan texts digitally as PDF scans. Now those that can be OCR'd, they are OCRing. They have a huge corpus of digital texts, and with huge corpora comes the problem of search. So we hope that our software can help improve the normal search experience of their users. We've already agreed, they've kindly said, you know, please run your software over our whole corpus. If it's useful, it's useful. If it's not, it hasn't hurt anyone. And we're planning to then build also an interface to their e-text corpus, so the general user hopefully will just happen to notice that search is improved. But the sophisticated, you know, linguistic user will be able to query part of speech combinations on this, you know, it's like 50 million words or something like that. Totally vast corpus. The TPRC is working with Kurt Kreutzer at the University of California, Berkeley, on improving Tibetan OCR. And they already use word breaking to improve their OCR. I think that part of speech tagging could also improve OCR, where, you know, if the OCR system is not sure, is it this or is it this, and one of the two is particularly probable on part of speech grounds, that can improve the OCR, and we can have a sort of a virtuous cycle where the OCR gets better, we get more robust conclusions about Tibetan grammar, we get more robust conclusions, we get better part of speech tagging, better part of speech tagging, better OCR. And I'll be in Berkeley for a while next academic year, and hopefully talking to Kurt and maybe something will happen, I don't know. Oops. Then the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, we have Professor Zhang Di, and they in China have already OCR systems, part of speech tagging systems, word breaking systems, even Tibetan to Chinese machine translation. And we have read those articles that we could in English, that we could get our hands on, but our project has not been enriched as much as it could be by work going on in China. And we don't have any concrete plans exactly yet, but definitely hope to collaborate and have already discussed, for instance, a special issue of a journal where colleagues in China can publish in English about the results they've made in Tibetan NLP. And then I say to all of you, if you're interested in corpus linguistics, Tibetan texts, if you have 90 volumes that you want to read, somehow there's some way that a computer can help you do what you want to do faster and you know, more efficiently, more rigorously, and hopefully you can use some of our software, build on it for your own research purposes and your own, to satisfy your own desires. So to imagine what could possible future projects look like, and these reflect, let's say, informal conversations I've had with Tibetologists around the world. If you're interested in modern history or politics, maybe you would be interested in a corpus of the Tibet Daily Newspaper through its whole output. You know, a daily newspaper for 60 years, that's a huge amount of data. And for lots of purposes, it would be interesting to search that data. You could imagine even some semi-automated techniques where a change in policy, a major event, might be reflected in spikes in certain keywords. And you could even, you know, have the computer scan newspapers and look for changes in keyword patterns and then focus in on what was going on at that time. Also, if you're interested in contemporary culture, you know, Tibetan youth culture online, blogs and the like, internet literature, you could have some word breaker and part of speech tagger that's crawling the web, gathering together whatever it finds, part of speech tagging it, and you could look at changes in the Tibetan language in real time. You know, how do you say selfie stick in Tibetan? And even imagine like a monthly newsletter that says, you know, new Tibetan word of the month, in the way that the OED has, like, you know, English word of the year. So these are two possible projects, depending on what you're interested in, history, philosophy, religion. I'm sure there's some way that you, as a Tibetologist at least, want to consult Tibetan texts where having little problems like which laws mean at and which laws mean mountain pass worked out for you in advance would be would be useful. And then also those people who aren't per se interested in Tibetan, who do corpus linguistics or digital humanities, I would say, hasn't English gotten a little boring? So maybe it's time to, you know, look to a language that's just as old, just as rich, has a vast literature, and let's say has gotten up to this point already in terms of its computational status. So that's it for my presentation of current problems and future directions.